I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. As a child, Sandra Allen was told that her Uncle Bob was crazy, that he'd spent time in mental hospitals while growing up in the 60s and 70s. As an adult, she learned there was much more to Uncle Bob. Today, Allen shares some of that story and explains how his schizophrenia diagnosis and treatment affected not just his life, but their entire family. Then, ahead of a series of community conversations hosted by Kansas City Public Schools, we sit down with Superintendent Mark Bedell and find out what he hopes to accomplish with the meetings. Later, Bill Brownlee presents this week's Local Listen. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. In 2009, Sandra Allen's uncle mailed her his autobiography. It was more than 60 pages of error-riddled, all-cap sentences, single-space, and sometimes incomprehensible. Her uncle, Bob, billed it as the true story of a boy who was unable to identify with reality. It took her a while to read the quote-unquote crazy uncle story, years in fact, but when she did, she found a window into the mind of Uncle Bob, a diagnosed paranoid schizophrenic, and a lens into something that is unimaginable to most people. Sandra Allen is a writer, reporter, and editor, and author of A Kind of Miraculous Paradise, and she joins us now from NPR Studios in New York. Sandra, thanks for taking some time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, this all started with a trip you took with some friends, and you all visited your Uncle Bob in California while you were in the area. Tell us how you then came to get Bob's autobiography in the mail.
Sure, yeah. I didn't know this uncle very well. He called himself a hermit and lived in the desert, and I had gone to see him once, as you mentioned. I'd driven past his house and stopped in and seen him when I was an adult. He wasn't someone who we grew up visiting, and I think he was someone I wondered about. I'd heard that he was crazy, but I didn't really know what that meant. And then I was just starting my graduate program in Iowa, and I got a call from a number that wasn't in my phone, and it was my Uncle Bob, who had a very recognizable voice, and he asked to mail me something that he'd written, and I said, sure, you know. And it showed up, and at first I thought, oh gosh, what is this? You know, your family member sends you some absolutely incomprehensible thing typed in all capital letters, very misspelled, punctuated with colons. The pages themselves, you know, stunk like cigarettes. And really, I didn't know what he wanted from me or why he was mailing this to me. In retrospect, I think one of the reasons he mailed it to me was he wanted help with his writing, and I was the only writer that he knew. So he was sending me his original typewritten on a typewriter manuscript in order to ask my help in getting his story out there. We talked on the phone pretty soon after, and he said he wanted to get his story out there because it was true. And I think this book is my fulfilling that request. I've gotten his story out there, and I've put the word true on the cover, A Kind of Miraculous Paradise, a true story about schizophrenia.
Is he still alive?
No, Uncle Bob is no longer alive.
So he didn't live long enough to see the fruits of his labor come to life here.
He did believe in heaven. So if he's right about that, I'd say he is watching all of this, and I'd say he's pretty stoked about it. I don't know if he ever imagined it would get this far where, you know, lovely people would be hearing me talk about this book on the radio, but I think he actually did believe that this story had the power to reach a lot of people. And I think that, you know, I'm an example of someone who I started out pretty skeptical that I could even read it, let alone that it would have anything to say to me. But I was quite wrong about that. And then over time, I think what I found is other people too are realizing, like, there's a really powerful series of messages in these pages that may look crazy.
How did you regard him, both as a kid and maybe later in your life? I mean, did he scare you?
Oh, no. He was, I didn't spend a lot of time with him as a kid. As I write about in the book, I was, occasionally we would be in Minnesota on vacation together, and he was a musician, a guitarist, and I was a singer, and so often we would sit and play music together. And he was also very funny. He was a really funny guy. And his book, when I eventually, as a grad student, did read the entire manuscript he'd sent, I realized, like, this is a really funny story. And it's also a very, there's a lot of adventure in it, and there was a lot of tragedy, and there was just so much that I realized how small of an impression I had had on this person based on the interactions we'd had and what I'd heard in the family compared to this really enormous life that he had lived. And then he had very carefully recounted in this story that he'd written. So I regarded him as a curiosity, I would say, but also someone who I felt a kinship with, I think because we were both creative people in the family. And I'd say that's another answer that I've sort of decided about why he sent it to me, because I think he recognized that I was someone in the family who was perhaps going to be willing to hear his story. Because I think before I could ever endeavor to write anything about Bob or anything based on what he'd typed, I needed to really hear what he'd written. And so I think he probably sensed that I was somebody in the family who was going to be more sympathetic naturally and somebody who also had a sense of humor, because I think that was a big part of who he was.
Yeah, I was really struck as a kid. Your mom just told you that Uncle Bob was crazy, and I'm wondering, what did that mean to you back then?
Yeah, I think that's one of the things I try to put right in the beginning of A Kind of Miraculous Paradise, because I think a lot of us have a family member, maybe multiple, who people kind of go, oh, yeah, that person. Well, you know, don't ask about them. You know. And I think that's something I've found through the years of 8 years that I've been working on this project. I've had a lot of conversations with random people, and they often end up revealing, sometimes very, you know, in a hushed tone, oh, I have an aunt, or I have a, you know, a relative who we don't talk about. And I think that that's actually one of the that's one of the topics of this book, is the shroud of silence that I think a lot of the rest of us can cast around people who have been labeled with a psychiatric diagnosis like schizophrenia. Is that we decide that therefore that's something scary or something that needs to be regarded sort of in a hushed tone. And I think that this book, and especially with my decision to put, you know, a true story about schizophrenia across its cover, I'm very much trying to smash a silence that I think has often been pulled around this topic.
You know, to what extent do you think our country is really beginning to come to grips with the whole notion and topic of mental illness? Because you get a sense, like in so many other parts of society, that people now are willing to engage in these conversations and be a little more forthright about what all this is about.
That's a good question. I think there's a lot going on. The one very important shift, and one that I hope that this book will encourage and inspire people ask all of us to open our minds more, is I think we need to listen more to people like Bob, people who are psychiatrically diagnosed with something like schizophrenia, people who are labeled this way, people who are most routinely silenced in the course of these conversations. Because really, if you think about knowledge about psychiatric disorders, well, right now, our points of view, and I'm speaking about kind of the public generally, our points of view are very much based in what psychiatry says about these things. It turns out there's a lot of other people, including my uncle, who've been on the other side of that system, who have a lot to say about themselves, about their minds, about their experiences, about a label like schizophrenia. And so this project, one of its most central endeavors is to really elevate the voice of Bob in order, I think, to ask all of us, well, what would happen if we brought Bob into this conversation? And my finding through the course of the 8 years that I worked on this book was Bob specifically, but also lots of people who've been in positions like Bob, being thrown in a psychiatric cell, being injected with antipsychotics, etc., being deeply stigmatized by the rest of the public. The people in that position have a lot of wise things to share with the rest of us about what psychiatric care, about what mental health care could look like, about what better mental health care could consist of. I think that was one of the true surprises of my uncle's story, was realizing, oh, this contains wisdom, and it's a story that's much bigger than just him.
Sandra Allen is my guest. Her new book, A Kind of Miraculous Paradise, it's about her uncle Bob, who suffered from schizophrenia. What did you know about schizophrenia when you decided to tackle the manuscript here?
Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Bob wrote on his book's cover page, his own manuscript that my book is based on. This is a true story of a young boy coming of age in Berkeley, California in the 1960s and 70s who was unable to identify with reality and therefore labeled a psychotic, paranoid, schizophrenic for the rest of his life. So he had put that term, psychotic, paranoid, schizophrenic, on the cover of his own manuscript that my book is based on. And in a sense, it was like a challenge in the course of trying to translate his story into something that I felt more readers would be able to understand and just engage with. That was part of my goal. I just wanted people to listen. I just wanted people to listen to Bob's story because I thought, oh, this is such a great story. But there was this problem of that phrase, you know, psychotic, paranoid, schizophrenic. And I was deeply aware of my lack of expertise in anything that related to that phrase. And so I really, through the course of the 8 years that I worked on A Kind of Miraculous Paradise, I was trying to figure out, okay, what does this mean? And then what do I need to tell my readers? You know, what does the reader need in order to get through the story? And what kinds of questions are going to come up in a reader's mind that I just want to answer in advance, you know, to make sure that they can just buckle in and continue to listen to Bob's story. And so I think that the book, it is Bob's story, but it's also the story of me crawling out of ignorance to an extent, you know, that I started off with very vague and very negative ideas of what schizophrenic meant or what you know, these were ideas that I had received from where? From the news, from popular culture. And I don't think I need to even spell out what some of these very small ideas that we tell each other about what a schizophrenic is or what a crazy person is, you know? So I think I carried a lot of those standard bigotries. And I think that the book is me showing my journey to a place of better understanding. And that comes as a result of really witnessing Bob's story. But also what I hope to do in the book is kind of bring more people into this conversation, give them a little bit of the history. Okay, where does this diagnosis schizophrenia, when does it get invented? What is it referring to when it's first invented? What's known about this now? What's not known? What has a century of research shown us about people who are given this diagnosis and also about mental health care?
Yeah. I was just so struck by the fact that you eventually took the time to open this manuscript and actually read it. You know, as a reporter for a long time here in Kansas City, you know, any number of times you get these big packages in the mail from inmates, for instance, or other people who enclose a manuscript and want you to spend time with it and read it. And of course, you never do because you got 10,000 other things to do.
Right.
What actually caused you to sit down one day and actually begin to read this thing?
I tell this story in A Kind of Miraculous Paradise. So I ignored the manuscript at first when Bob sent it to me. I really did. I had just moved. I was busy with school.
And it was a mess, right? We're talking about a sprawling mess here, right?
It had profanity in it. It was so off-putting. And so I put it in a drawer and I tried to ignore it. But because it was a typewritten original, I didn't throw it away. You know, I think I had this sense like this is special and it probably took him a long time, but I really didn't want to get into it. And what eventually broke me, it's so silly. I got this gift from him. I got a big box that he must have ordered online from like the QVC or a catalog of jams and jellies in tiny jars. And I lugged this big box up to my apartment and looked at all these little jams and jellies. And I thought, man, you know, this man has never given me a gift, you know, and I didn't think he had much money. And I felt so terribly guilty that he was taking time out of his life to send me, you know, this story. He really wanted me to read this story. And here I didn't even have the decency to read the entire story. So I made myself toast with boysenberry preserves. And I sat down and I read Bob's true story of his life. And as I write in the book, you know, one way to encapsulate everything that's followed is I have never stopped reading his book. And I think that writing from his book is in continued service of trying to witness the story he told and then to make good on his desire that I get the story out there. And in the course of translating his story into a form that more people could appreciate, I think what happened was I realized oh, this is important. I think a lot of the rest of us think we know what schizophrenia means, or we think we know what schizophrenic means, and we think we know that that person, I don't know, doesn't deserve to be heard. And I realized, like, oh no, that is the crux of it. And that's the thing that I can help people begin to understand in themselves, and hopefully begin to let society let go of some of the prejudice that I think we really easily carry around, particular to this label.
Sandra Allen's new book, A Kind of Miraculous Paradise, it's about schizophrenia. The way this book is formatted, it's got long excerpts from Bob's manuscript followed, you know, by a few pages of your own follow-up reporting that you did years later. Why did you do it that way?
That's a good question. So the book is written in two fonts. The first is my translation of Bob's story. So it's my interpretation of his prose. Basically, he had written in these all capital letters, and I sort of take the material he gives and I spin it into the story. And that's really the bulk of the book, is just this story. And then in another font, I have another voice that comes in, and it opens with the story that, you know, you told us at the beginning of receiving this in the mail. And it's a space where, as you say, I come in and give greater context sometimes. And I think the reason it was important to do that was that I realized that in order for people to really listen to this story, I think sometimes they're going to wonder stuff. They're going to wonder questions about the family. They're going to wonder questions about the historical period. This book takes place in Berkeley in the 1960s and 70s. It's a very tumultuous time and place, and one that is really rich. And I sort of found myself eager to tell people stories as I had done research in that time and, around that time and place. And so the experience of the book is one that hopefully is fun for readers. That was really one of my goals, is I wanted to try to counter that prejudice that a lot of us have by writing a book that was deeply fun and kind of made you want to keep reading.
Right.
But yeah, it has these two fonts, these two modes that you jump between. And I think part of the point is that, you know, the truth of it all lies somewhere in between all of these things. And there's lots of facts that are brought in the book that don't necessarily square with one another. And that is the way of the world when it comes to a conversation around something like schizophrenia, which is a highly contested category.
I was going to say, how similar do you think Bob's writing was to what was going on in his brain at the time that he wrote it?
Well, I'd say that Bob was a very... his goal in writing this book was to write a true story. That's the first phrase on his manuscript's cover. And it's something that other relatives who knew him well also emphasized to me. You know, he really wanted people to believe his story. They wanted his story to... He worked very hard on it because he wanted it to not be perceived as untrue. And so his writing was, and this was something I discovered kind of over the years that I was really looking at it, it was meticulous. It had initially appeared very messy, and over time I realized, oh no, this is extremely meticulous. It's chronologically ordered. There's a lot of detail here that I would be, in later years, you know, I reported his story out, you know, I fact-checked it. I called everyone I could find who had also lived through the events that he described. I asked them, how did you experience this? Do you remember this? Hey, he says that. Do you remember that? And I found people, I called people on the phone who I thought were fictional. You know, I tracked down people and I asked them how they remembered it, and they verified things that I was astounded, you know. And I think that was one of the things that really happened over time, was realizing, oh, I had a lot of assumptions about what this man's story would be based on, I don't know, prejudices I held. And then instead, when I really looked at it, I realized this book barely has an extraneous hair on its head. You know, it's very together. It's very tight. And it was this incredible base document from which I was able to spin this story that I hope will be attractive to kind of a wider range of readers.
And that's just kind of amazing to me that what seemed to be an absolute train wreck turned out to be something very, very different once you got into it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things in this that have surprised me.
So when was Bob's first brush with the mental health system, Sandra? When did that happen?
So he was 16 years old, and he had just been kicked out of high school. This is by his account. He had been fighting at school at Berkeley High. He'd been kicked out of school, and then his dad had driven him down to a hospital, and he was taken into a psychiatric cell. He was injected with things. You know, he didn't know what he was being injected with, and then the cell door was shut, and he was left there. And he was 16, you know, and that's really the opening of the story, is his life to that point, and then that, and everything that follows that. And I think that one of the real lessons in this is, how do you possibly recover from something like that? How do you possibly, you know, I've spent years thinking about that. Wow, what would have happened to me if at 16 I had been driven to a hospital and tossed in a cell and injected with stuff and left, and just the trauma of that. And I think that my project hopefully witnesses that trauma at the very least, because I do think there are a lot of people in positions like Bob where they've experienced stuff under the pretense of psychiatric care that itself was quite damaging, and they've wanted to be heard on that topic. And in Bob's case, I realized, like, this is a big part of whatever he became after this point was deeply affected by these experiences. And this sort of debate around, oh, well, what kind of disorder did he have before this, or what, you know, is there a genetic defect that he has, or is there a chemical imbalance in his brain, all these kinds of questions, it becomes impossible to strip this away from the fact of having been put in that cell. So he was 16 when he entered the mental health care system, and my story follows him through the course of his life. And in his late teens and in his 20s, he's in and out of hospitals quite a bit. It's
right.
It's kind of the drumbeat of the book, because he ends up back in the hospital, and he gets better, and then he's back out. And once he's back out in the world, what is he doing? He's doing all the stuff that anybody would do. He's trying to find a job. He's trying to find some friends. He's trying to find a girlfriend. He's trying to regain a semblance of dignity. And I think that that's one of the things that I've realized is also pretty common when you speak with people who've been, you know, psychiatrically diagnosed with schizophrenia or other severe mental illnesses. It's often the case that people are trying to move forward, trying to regain
right.
some sense of, especially if they've suffered kind of socially, you know, as a result of that hospitalization, or they're viewed differently by everyone who knows them because of the fact of having
right.
been taken to a hospital.
Sandra, I just got a minute left here, so maybe a final question. Why couldn't he maintain his independence permanently? What did you conclude?
Oh, well, so he lived for decades in that house in the desert. He lived on government disability. A lot of people who are diagnosed with schizophrenia receive disability payments, and he kept a checkbook, and he took care of his dogs, and he read the Bible, and he played guitar, and he wrote down the story of his life, and he received money from his mom and dad, who had money to give him. And so he was an independent person. He took care of himself for decades. And I think that was also something I wanted to witness in this story, is we might have a sense that this man, you know, his life would have been one thing or another based on hearing that word schizophrenia. But instead, what I realized was this man took care of himself for a long time, and he wrote down his life story as accurately as he was able to do it. And I can say, as a reporter, kind of having circled back, I'm going, yeah, you did a really good
right,
job writing
right.
down your entire life.
Sandra Allen, again, her new book, A Kind of Miraculous Paradise. It's all about her uncle Bob, who suffered from schizophrenia. And Sandra, it's an amazing story. Thanks for taking some time with us today. I sure appreciate it.
Oh, thank you.
Time for a break. When we come back here, Kansas City School Superintendent Mark Bedell joins us. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday, we examined why current political discourse is stressing so many of us out, and we got some tips for dealing with it. You can find that conversation and others at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, we'll help you demystify Missouri's recently proposed budget, and we'll get some reviews from regular folks on President Trump and his first year in office. That's tomorrow's Up to Date. Well, Kansas City School Superintendent Mark Bedell is getting out again to meet with district patrons and parents in a series of community meetings beginning Thursday night. Topics on the table include responding to public input gathered during his last tour around the district's next strategic plan, and finding ways that parents and neighbors can contribute to the school system's long-term success. The superintendent joins me now in the studio. And Mark Bedell, always good to have you here. Welcome back, Mark.
Thank you, Steve, and thank you for having us today.
What are you hoping to accomplish with these meetings that you're looking at here?
It's pretty simple. We have really focused on being transparent. And one of the things that I shared with the community roughly 2 years ago, because it was close to this time when they made the announcement
that you were coming here. Yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. was that we wanted to make sure that there were multiple modalities that we were utilizing to communicate with the community at large. We wanted to be transparent, not only with our community, but you all in terms of the media, and just being honest about where we are, where we plan to head. And so this is an opportunity for us to follow up based on our listening and learning tours that we had and the feedback that we gathered. We've created a strategic plan that really encompasses the majority of the areas for growth that the community said they wanted to focus on. So now we want to go over that with the community and let them know that we have listened to them, and here's where we are and here's where we're going.
What are the main tenets of the strategic plan that you're referring to here, Mark?
So part of it is we talk about four pillars within our strategic plan, and these are the things that adults have to do. And what we heard from the community was that they wanted us to develop caring working relationships with students. They wanted us to make sure that we had a curriculum that made sense, that was aligned, and that we were focusing on helping kids to transition. So that's pillar A. Pillar B is what the community said was we want more parental involvement. We want more partnerships. So pillar B focuses on schools can't do it alone, and that deals with safe climate and strong relationships with family and community. They also said, we want to have teachers who care. We want principals who care. So pillar C focuses on caring, effective teachers in every classroom and effective leaders in every school. And then the most important part is they also talked about perception, customer service, helping us to do a better job of controlling the narrative. That's pillar D, really managing the whole organization, but utilizing data to be honest and transparent about where we are, but then also providing customer service that our people and our community deserve.
Kansas City, Missouri School District Superintendent Mark Bedell is my guest. You know, at a recent meeting of the Kansas City Star editorial board that I attended with you, Mark, you were talking at some length about what can the community do to help the district. This notion that the responsibility of carrying on the work of educating our kids doesn't just fall on the shoulders of the superintendent and the teachers. It involves everyone to some degree or another. What can the community do? What do you want to see happen?
I would tell you the number one thing that this community can do is continue to help portray a positive narrative of this school district. You remember, we've been a school district that has constantly been projected to decline in enrollment. We think because of the narrative that has shifted a little bit that this year, instead of us having a decline in enrollment of over 300 children, we actually started this school year with 45 more kids than what we started with last year. So on top of not regressing, we did increase our enrollment. But a lot of that comes from people going out and looking at the district through more of a resiliency lens and speaking positive words of affirmation about what they see is taking place in this school district. So we need that.
So if enrollment's going up, that suggests that people are feeling good about what the product they receive.
I think absolutely. I think also that we're being honest about where we are too, and people want to know, hey, when are we going to be a fully accredited school system? What will it take? And this is the other piece where the community must help, and it's going to be a big part of my conversation with them. We can bring in the greatest instructional leaders, and I happen to think that I have a superior instructional leader in Dr. Marla Shepherd that we were able to pull from Fort Bend ISD and outside of Texas, Houston, Texas. We can have all of that. You can have Dr. Bedell, who really is involved in the community. But if I can't get the kids to come to school, and that's a lot of that is about our community stepping up and making sure that we don't give people reasons to opt out. We need these kids in school. This district has been struggling to get kids to attend school. We cannot get the 90-90, which we're going to talk about tomorrow, 90% of kids in school, 90% of time in class. If we can't get that number up, then we're just going to have the same repetitive results.
Let's talk about that, because attendance was one of the three areas where the district fell short when it came to regaining full accreditation here. This basic idea that you just outlined of getting kids into classrooms so they can be taught. What's the issue?
I think
what's happening out there?
It's multifaceted. Let me say that. One is, If the conditions aren't ripe, I think that we tell our kids that it's okay for you not to go to school today because the weather isn't right, right? Or if the kid has a tummy ache or something like that, because if you are at your 90-90 attendance rate is at 87% for kindergartners, it only gets worse from there. Now, kindergartners don't decide whether or not they want to come to school. that's on us as a parents and as a community to say, these kids need to be in school. The second phase to that is, if we have adults that aren't doing their part, and what I mean by that is, if conditions aren't right, and let's just use school bus drivers as an example, and it's not all of them, but I mean, I'll give you a story of one school bus driver who clearly told our principal after the day that we canceled school two Thursdays ago, the bus driver told the principal, I wasn't getting out in that cold weather. So now we got a busload of kids at an elementary school who do not get to go to school, and we have situations where our families don't, in many cases, have the means to get these kids to school, so now they're at home, and it's because of adult behavior. So we have to do everything in our power to say that we're going to, whether the conditions are ripe or not, we owe it to these kids that everybody shows up ready to work. That's teachers, custodians, executive level people, whomever, so that these kids can get the education that they deserve.
Yeah, I want to be clear here, because the state of Missouri is laying down this requirement that if you want to be fully accredited, you've got to meet these attendance benchmarks, right? The idea being, if kids aren't in school, they're not getting educated, you can't have a district be accredited if not enough kids are in classrooms.
That's correct. And the other thing that kills the 90-90 piece is tardiness. So people have to understand that 90-90 is based on you being in school 90% of the day. If you fall at 89%, so if you miss 14% of the day, which is in essence you miss the first period of your school day, you're in absence for a 90-90 purposes, you get a zero for the day. Mm-hmm. Even though for the average daily attendance, you're marked as present, well, that helps us with funding, but it doesn't help us with the accountability that the state of Missouri utilizes in order for us to get our accreditation.
So how can the community help you with attendance, Mr. Superintendent? What can happen here?
I would tell you that we have to begin to have conversation to hold each other accountable, to say, hey, you need to get your kids to school. You have an administration here. You have a board of education here. They are all working well together. They have an instructional plan in place, a strategic plan in place. These people care. And trust me, if we can get them to come to school, we can take care of the other part. Mm-hmm. I promise you.
How far short of the 90% benchmark is the Kansas City, Missouri School District?
Right now, on average, the last 3 years, we're averaging around 79-80%, far below the 90% mark that the state wants.
You got 10 points to go.
And that's hard, because anytime you look at attendance, everywhere that I've worked around the country, generally you see increases of tenths of points a year. Like, it's really hard to move. And so even if we're at 79 or 80%, the most you're going to expect to see in growth, if you're lucky, you might get 2 percentage points. But in most cases, you just don't see that type of growth happen overnight. So it's going to be a process, which means that it will continue to be an Achilles heel of ours until we can get everybody to consistently say, these kids have to come to school, and every single minute of the day matters, right? Not just coming in late and then thinking that that's not going to harm anything. It does harm us on 90-90.
You know, getting back to the point that you've made many times, that the problems that your district faces are so different than what a Blue Valley faces, than what a Lee Summit faces. Here's one problem. I've heard you talk about this idea that for some kids, getting to school means walking on dangerous streets. They don't feel safe walking to school for one reason or another. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, we heard that directly from the kids. Last year, we conducted what we called brown bag lunch with the superintendent. And one of our questions that we asked our students was to tell us about what life is like outside of school. And the kids were sharing with us that there are times when they can't go outside and play. And these are conversations that I've had with the mayor and the county county executive. But I shared, this is what my kids are telling us. You know, they're worried about the safety within their neighborhoods. They're worried about walking to and from school. They're worried about things happening. And some of these kids shared some vivid stories with us that actually had myself and my chief communication officer having to walk out the room tearing up a little bit because of what they said that they were experiencing in terms of some of the violence that was occurring. And so, and these are middle school kids, you know, this particular example were middle school kids, but we heard this from quite a few of our kids. And so the neighborhood components do impact us, right? And we need to recognize that once again, it is going to take the community to say, we're going to rise up above what's happening in the community because our kids deserve to be able to navigate to and from school safely. And it's part of us all holding each other accountable to make sure that that happens.
I was going to say, it doesn't seem unreasonable to me that a safe passage to school would be something that kids could count on, but they're struggling with that here. You know, some cities I've come to learn, like Chicago, actually have programs in place, a safe passage program, if you will. Certain streets are designated as streets where kids know they can go and walk safely to get to the school they need to get to. What do you want to see happen here in Kansas City?
I mean, I would love to be able to see if we could replicate something like that. I think our mayor is definitely concerned about what's happening with crime. Our police commissioner, I had an opportunity to meet with him recently. I think we all are. But it's a matter of us all coming together and sitting down and really talking through what does that look like? How do we make sure that that happens for our children? And like I said, I'm not sitting here. I'm not making up anything. I'm not making excuses. I'm telling you and I'm providing context because these are the things that we're hearing directly from our students that they believe are some of the variables and barriers that contribute to them possibly not getting to school on time or not coming to school at all. And so these are variables in many cases that are beyond the control of the school district.
Yeah.
You know, but the school district has a responsibility in mobilizing and working with the other entities within the city to say, how do we create a solution? Because I'm not a person that's interested in making excuses. I told you all that at the editorial board. We want to be held accountable, and we expect you to report it and call it like you see it. All I'm saying is utilize context when you do it, because you're right. You can't compare me to a Lee Summit. You can't compare me to a Blue Spring. You're going to compare me to like districts like ours around the state, and then let's have that conversation.
Kansas City, Missouri School Superintendent Dr. Mark Bedell is my guest. The phone lines are open. If you have a question for the superintendent, 816-235-2888 is the number. Again, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. The other piece I've heard from your staff that might help with attendance is this notion of mentorships. You know, adults reaching out to kids who need some adult guidance in their lives and connecting with them that way. What would you like to see happen there?
Yeah, that's a big deal for me, and it's something that we are working on right now. We've launched our portfolio mentoring program. We have about a total of 101 students or so that have already been paired. We have another 103 that are on a waiting list, mm-hmm. and we want to make sure that we get the proper matches. But we're doing a lot with mentoring.
It's a big
right
brother,
now.
Big sister kind of idea.
It's similar, but I mean, like, there's different aspects because under this portfolio model, it can be corporations that want to come in and do something. It could be people who want to just have lunch with kids and form a relationship. Then it could be people like me who said, where the portfolio model works is that it's customized. I mentor a kid, and he had to meet two conditions. He needs to have been dealt a real bad hand in life, right? And he needs to also be interested in sports, because then I can reach this kid through sports, and then from sports, I can
start. You're a big basketball player.
You got it. Absolutely.
Yeah. And then I actually have heard you're pretty good.
I'm okay.
I'm not sure you're as good as I was at my peak, for the record.
I'm a much older guy now, so it's a struggle. I tried to catch a hoop the other day, and I think I may have put my back out of place. But
I got two new hips, but I'm wondering if I could still take you.
Well, hey, every Saturday at Central after the game's over, you're welcome to come.
You're welcome to come try it.
And we
right?
do open it up to the community. So we've had community members come in, teachers, principals, cops. I mean, Kevin Holmes from Channel 41. So it has been a great way to bring the community together, to fellowship through basketball. I bring a nice speaker. We listen to music. We have a great time. And it's just an opportunity to take care of ourselves and exercise.
Yeah. But your point is you can connect to a kid through sports in your mentoring.
But that's the beautiful part of the portfolio model. So through sports, and then I can start to tap into what's going on in his personal life. Because then I can say, you've been dealt a nasty hand in life, so was I, But let me tell you what I did to navigate through it, and let me give you the recipe for how you can get through your situation.
Right.
And so it don't have to be that you're being paired with a kid like that. The portfolio model allows for you, if you're interested in somebody who wants to go into journalism, and maybe they've gone through a background like yours, and you think you can give back to that kid and help that kid, I just want kids to be mentored.
Right, right. What's the biggest factor that's preventing your attendance numbers from being what they need to be?
Well, I would tell you it's the inability of us to get kids to come to school every day and to come to school on time. Mm-hmm. That's one.
Right.
And then I would also say, because we've had a lot of transportation issues, and we're working it out. Transportation is much better this year, but it's not where I want it to be. I feel like we still have transportation concerns, and if we don't have full-time bus drivers or active bus drivers that are going to show up every day, then that also impacts us, because some of my parents are working multiple jobs.
Right.
They just don't have the ability to take their kids to school like I can.
Right.
And if the part of we get funded for transportation, that's an obligation that we have as a school system. So it needs to be dependable. It needs to be dependable.
Let's go to some phone calls at 816-235-2888 for Dr. Mark Bedell, the superintendent of Kansas City, Missouri's school district. Andre from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Good morning, Dave. How are you?
Well, thanks.
Good morning.
Good morning, Dr. Bedell. I was wondering maybe I'm concerned with the attendance as well.
You're cutting out a little bit, Andre.
I'm sorry?
You're cutting out a little bit.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was wondering if, we could use, a blended public-private, maybe services.
You know, we're losing you, Andre, but the question has to do with whether you've had any conversations with the city planning department to use the trans model. I don't know what that
is. Okay, perfect. That's an excellent question. So I will tell you that we have worked with the transit authority. We had already drafted an MOU with them. There is state statute from a legislative standpoint that's pretty much been on the books for decades. I don't know if it's 70 or 80 years, but there's legislation right now from the Columbia Public Schools where they're basically trying to say that needs to change. And we've gotten on board to support that in Jefferson City as a part of their legislative agenda, because if we can do that, then we open up so many more opportunities for our kids to have transportation. We had worked out where we were going to have our kids at the high school level have ID badges that had a magnet strip on it that they could use when they hopped on the transit authority buses, and would be able to, we wanted to pilot it, to utilize it for extracurricular activities first, mm-hmm. and then to see how that would work. But because of the funding structure from the state, we're not in a position where we would do that. We could potentially lose funding if we partner with the transit authority. But there is legislation that has already been pre-filed and has already been accepted by some of the legislators that we are supporting. But, yep, we were looking at doing that.
We just have a few minutes left, Mr. Superintendent. So let's just touch on accreditation, because people always wonder about that issue when you visit. What's your latest thinking on when you expect the district to regain full accreditation at the earliest here? What's the latest thinking?
It has changed. I told you all last time that I came here that I told the board 3 to 4 years. I would tell you that I'm proud to sit here and say what I'm looking at right now is possibly – If things work out the way we believe it will work out in terms of full accreditation, we'd have to hit 70 this year. We'd have to hit 70 again next year, maybe 2 to 3. I believe we'll hit the 70 for certain next year. We may hit it this year, but for certain next year with what we've put in place, and we think that it will be sustainable. We can get help on this attendance piece. It helps all of the other areas in terms of how we can educate our kids and make sure that we're teaching them the curriculum the right way. But I feel much better than I did the last time I came here and spoke to you about the direction we're heading in because of what we've put in place from an instructional and a professional development standpoint.
Let's go to Mary from Kansas City, Missouri. Mary, you're on with Dr. Mark Bedell. Good morning.
Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Yes, I was wondering about starting a mentoring group as opposed to one-on-one. Maybe it's crazy, but just an idea of sharing the responsibility of mentoring two or three students with another adult, if that would work, because I'm pretty darn busy right now. But what? Who would I contact?
Yeah, so absolutely. Remember what I told you. This is a portfolio model. This is a unique model right now from what I'm hearing in the United States, because we have Robert Bow fans from Johns Hopkins who's gotten on board with this, and they will actually be conducting the research on this over the next 3 years. The reason why we said portfolio is so that we can do exactly what you said. That's another component of the portfolio model. We can customize it. So the name of the individual that you want to speak to is Daryl Davis. He is the assistant superintendent over our mentoring initiative. And if you go to our website, you go to mentoring@kcpublicschools.org, and that will lead you directly to Daryl and also Sharina Clinton, who is his coordinator. And then they will be able to talk to you about what next steps will look like. But we have a whole system built in, training and everything, for anybody who wants to mentor in our school district.
Mary, that was a great question. Thanks for asking it. And Dr. Bedell, every time you're here, I'm just reminded of about how much you're juggling every day with the district. Keep up the work. Good luck to you. Appreciate you coming in.
Thank you, and I appreciate all of the listeners.
Coming up this week's Local Listen with Bill Brownlee. KCUR music contributor Bill Brownlee joins me now in the studio, as he does most Wednesdays, to highlight Kansas City act with an upcoming show, and we call it our Local Listen. Bill, welcome back. Good to have you.
Thank you, Steve.
You want to talk about Lonnie McFadden?
I sure do. Most listeners are probably aware of Lonnie McFadden as the trumpet-playing half of the tap-dancing duo, the McFadden Brothers.
That's right.
Well, Lonnie is going back to his roots. His new album will be released in March. It's called Live at Green Lady Lounge. And on the project, Lonnie trades in his Vegas flash for some Kansas City swing.
Let's listen to Lonnie McFadden, this track, In the Club, from the forthcoming album, Live at Green Lady Lounge. Bill, you say this latest album, Live at Green Lady Lounge, is something of a departure for Lonnie McFadden. How so?
Well, he and his brother made their reputation with a Vegas-style review, with lots of tap dancing, covers of songs like Mr. Bojangles, and they spent a long time with Wayne Newton, the Las Vegas entertainer, as his opening act. And they did very well for themselves, and they still play shows in that vein. But as you can hear right now, Lonnie's playing his trumpet. He is playing with a terrific young Kansas City jazz combo. This is a real departure from what most people are used to from Lonnie.
You know, in your review of this album for your website, PlasticSax.com, you called it a winning blend of cornball shenanigans and refined artfulness. What does that mean?
You know, Lonnie is going to be Lonnie, and he has an eager-to-please personality. You know, and mm-hmm. he's a showman, and that's why people love him. And there's still some of that on this project. There's a lot of patter between songs in which he's just kind of naturally, and I mean this in a respectful sense, he's kind of a corny guy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's part of who he is. And that's all on this new album. But there's, you know, legitimate jazz chops like you're hearing now.
Fans want to know, Bill, when's the new album going to be released?
It'll be out in March. I don't know if Lonnie will be selling physical copies, which do exist, at his shows this weekend. He's every Friday afternoon at the Phoenix, which is just one of the classic Kansas City experiences, is seeing Lonnie McFadden to start your weekend on a Friday afternoon.
And he's also at Plaza 3 on Saturday, right?
And he's also at Plaza 3 on Saturday.
Okay, that's Bill Brownlee talking about Lonnie McFadden, a very well-known Kansas City musician. Bill, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Just a quick note, if district patrons want to take part in some of the community meetings, they can find out when and where those meetings are by going to kcpublicschools.org. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. You can follow me at Steve Kraske, and don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. Tomorrow, area residents share their thoughts on President Donald Trump 1 year into his term. We'll also dive into Missouri Governor Eric Greitens' state budget proposal to see which programs and services made the cut and which ones didn't. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Claire Verbeck. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.